Maybe you can clarify something for me. Since I've been, you know, waiting for the fleet to show up, I've read a lot.
And really?
And one of the things that keeps cropping up is this about subtext. Plays, novels, songs, they all have a subtext, which I take to mean a hidden message or import of some kind. So subtext, we know. But what do you call the message or meaning that's right there on the surface, completely open and obvious? They never talk about that. What do you call what's above the subtext?
The text.
Okay, that's right, but they never talk about that.
Welcome to The Drunken Odyssey with John King, a podcast about the writing life.
Tell us, muse, about a man whose mind and career has careened far and wide and upside down, whose computers are seared with crimes against grammar, whose typographical aggressions are legion, whose words flow into the very mouth of time, and more than a few bottles. A man who actually owns a typewriter, and perhaps even a soul.
And now, your host, John King.
Greetings, fellow writers, drunken Odysseans, and all you Myrmidians of the Midnight Lamp. I don't know what I'm saying much of the time. To episode 12 of The Drunken Odyssey. On today's show, I'll chat with Jonathan Starkey, who is the editor of Palooka, a literary magazine of underdog excellence. Rusty Kjarvik will discuss Nikos Kazantzakis, and I do my best to answer the metaphysical mail of Ryan Rivas. The fall 2012 term has begun here at the University of Central Florida, and the campus is aswarm with nearly 60,000 students, nearly all of whom carry germs. About 96 of these students are mine, and I did my best to inflame their aspirational minds, even if my own mind, by my fourth class, seemed a little bit hollow. Tropical Storm Isaac is churning up the seas below me as I record this. I am so far inland that even if the thing goes hurricane and comes straight for us, it won't be any sort of apocalyptic The Rise We're Watching God scenario. Not likely, anyway. Either here in the villages or in Orlando. I have a new essay about Salvador Dali's collaboration with Disney, the film Destino, that appeared in issue 25 of Celebrations magazine. It looks really good. Right after I record this, I'll be speeding west along I-4 to spend an hour or two with Jamie Hecker, my fellow Celebrations contributor. He's a fine writer, too. I met my deadline for a review for the Literary Review, although I've got some edits to do this weekend. I need to get my docket cleared up so I can work on a new book before the avalanche of grading begins in about 3 weeks. I think that's all the ado I have this week. Lauren, could you please tell our listeners where to find us?
For more information and updates about this podcast, friend us on Facebook at The Drunken Odyssey with John King. See our website at thedrunkenodyssey.com or email us at thedrunkenodyssey@gmail.com.
Nurse, refill, please.
And now, the interview of the day.
Jonathan Starkey is editor-in-chief of the literary magazine Palooka and also writes about his vagabond life at rockonvagabond.com. Welcome, Jonathan.
How are you doing?
I'm hanging in there today. In the interest of full disclosure, I appeared in issue number 2 of Palooka, and I was awfully proud to be in there. I think I responded to a call for submissions that you had sent out on the New Pages Guide. So I was wondering if you could talk about what the impetus for Palooka was.
Well, I've been submitting to literary magazines for probably about 8 years, and I had a chance to look at, I've had dozens and dozens and dozens of different ones ever since I actually started beginning. One of the professors that I was doing an independent study with had said, if I really want to understand that world and the kind of writing that I was wanting to do and that I had always read, I really needed to look at literary magazines and see what was kind of what was happening now. And so I started reading those back in 2004. And I just after so many years of sort of reading literary magazines, you start to, you know, really like certain things about them and really not like certain things about them. And I think that I had grown sort of frustrated with some things, you know, some articles I had read, things I had heard about the way some literary magazines function. And I thought that, I don't know, I'd always kind of just wanted to start my own. I think a lot of times the literary magazines are funded by universities or have some kind of backing, and I think they have to sort of pander to a certain audience a lot of times, or they have restrictions, or they sort of have to maintain what the magazine has done, you know, for years and years. And I think it's not as open, I guess, to change and to new things. Actually, I will say, though, that they have been, it's interesting that a lot of magazines I've been reading since, you know, for the last eight years or so, actually have done a lot of things to change and do different things with their websites and start doing the social networking. So that's actually pretty cool, like the Twitter and the Facebook and having feeds and blogs and all that kind of stuff. I think I wanted something where there wasn't anyone who was going to tell me you can't do this, or no, this cover is too, like the one you were into, the clowns we were talking about, like this is too much, people are going to hate this, they're going to be afraid of it, which some of them were. But I think way more thought it was really fascinating and loved to see it. And I just kind of wanted to be able to make the, and I also really love the idea of not just having fiction, nonfiction, poetry, that sort of standard three. I wanted to have graphic work in there. I wanted to have comics. I wanted to be able to do multimedia on the website, artwork, photography. And, you know, we had, with issue one, I think we had a piece that came to us, and it was like, I don't know, 30 or 40 pages. And we printed that. It was basically, we called it a novella, but it was shorter in our book because of how big the dimensions are. But yeah, it was just something where I didn't want any restrictions or guidelines. I just wanted to kind of do what I felt, you know, offer as many opportunities to as many writers as possible. And I wanted to have a magazine where everything is read blind. I never solicit any work. I wanted to give an opportunity to people who, you know, I know from my experience of submitting for the last 8 or 9 years, it is so difficult sometimes when you're submitting to some of these places. And they really do look at the cover letter first, and they really do care about who you are, who you know. And yeah, I think it's great when you can, you know, have a venue for people who have, I've published people who've never been published before, and they just have such great work to offer. And sometimes I think it's really hard to make that first step. And then you see all these great things they do after they published with you. A girl who was 15 years old, who's a photographer in the UK, published a photograph with us. So I think it's really cool to offer all of these opportunities for people, no matter your age or your background or, you know, what you do. I really don't actually, I mean, I care about the people. It's great to get to know them through their bios and stuff, but I don't care about what they've done before at all. I do not care about the resume. I actually say on the Submission Mash that I would much rather know about them as a person than about what they do or what they've done in the past, like a resume. And again, I don't even read the bios until after I've decided if I'm going to accept or reject a piece. So that was sort of what got me, I guess, going on this whole thing.
And so, as the title of Palooka suggests, you have something of an adversarial stance towards the literary establishment, even though Palooka is incredibly literary, I think, but it doesn't really try to fit in or simply coexist peacefully with other magazines. I think it does a lot to stand out and take some interesting risks.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that. I agree. I think in some ways it definitely was that I had an aversion to some of the things I had learned over all those years of submitting and going through the magazines. And I definitely love a lot. I mean, the fact that these exist, no matter what they're doing, I love that they do exist. With Palooka, I boxed in the past, and I don't see Palooka as the way some people use that word. I don't see it as a negative thing. I see it as an underdog. I see it as somebody who is just giving it their best. And I don't see it as that they're not talented. I see it as they're just not being given the right opportunity. That's how I use the word. I think, honestly, and when I really think about it, I wanted to start this magazine because I always had such a challenge until I really finally got my first publication. It was so challenging to go, I still have all of my rejection letters when actually, you know, when they were sending actual those little paper slips. I had 400 or 500 of these in a box, in a shoebox that I still have. And I think it was just so frustrating because I knew I had really good work. And it was just, I think it's very difficult when you know you're putting out work that you really believe in. And I felt like a lot of times I was being passed over because I literally had no credentials at all. I was I had no master's degree in creative writing, and no MFA, no, you know, nothing. I was just this guy who was writing. And I don't think all magazines are that way, but I do think it's very challenging when you have no resume whatsoever. I just think that you get less of a look, depending on, of course, how the process works for some of the magazines. They're all different, I'm sure. But yeah, and it's not, and so I think I had an aversion to that. But then there was also my, you know, a couple of my own experiences and attempting to publish my own work. And then really, it was just the idea that I loved, beyond that stuff, it was just, I loved the idea that I could give this opportunity to people and that I could create my own sort of community of people who sort of have shared those experiences and really want someone to be out there for them, not out there soliciting work to famous people who've already published in 1,000, you know, short stories and they don't need another one. I want to publish those people who need these stories and need their poetry published and need their photographs and artwork seen. And especially for artists, they have really no venue except for maybe their own website and possibly galleries that are local to get their stuff out there. So I love the fact that, for instance, the cover on issue 3 is from a guy living in India that I have a really good relationship with now. He actually just sent me that painting as a gift in the mail. So it's really great to develop these relationships with these people who have no other outlet. And I think Palooka is a really great outlet for people who are really struggling. And again, it's not like I target only people who are kind of, you know, who haven't been published. I will, you know, I don't care because I, like I said, don't read the cover letters. So like you've been in some very good places and we published a couple of your poems, but if the work moves me, I take it, you know, and I have no other guidelines or there are no other parameters for why I would select something other than if I just get that feeling, you know, then it's like, all right, I'm taking it. And I just don't care about the other stuff.
Well, and I think it's an interesting dynamic when you have one editor who's doing most of the reading and is making those decisions, whereas in a lot of literary magazines, like you say, so many of them are sponsored by universities and a lot of decisions get made by committee.
Yep.
And I've been in those meetings at Sycamore Review, and I will say we didn't always publish what I thought was the best stuff. Because, and I learned, you know, I had to pick my battles and I would vote for, I would really go balls out for one story that was maybe a little experimental or a little bit contrary. And I would say, no, this one is wonderful. And then I would put my vote in. It felt like, you know, backdoor Senate deals. Okay, I'll vote. If you let this one in, then I'll let this other one in that I think is not bad, but not really that interesting.
Yeah. That is such an interesting way to talk about it. I read everything. I read every single piece. The other thing I try and do, which I don't think, I mean, I, well, you know, I read, it's not like, you know, I know that some places get so many submissions that it's like, well, you know, you read the first sentence and you say, okay, well, nope, not going to take this. I know it's not that, you know, it's not for us, it's not for me, whatever, and they reject it.
Yeah.
I really do read everything, and I read it all the way through because I remember, you know, the interesting thing about that is I've had people talk to me and tell me that, you know, publication doesn't matter as much to them as just being read. They want to be read. And I don't know, it just really moved me that people, that's what this really is about. It's weird that we kind of forget. This is about reaching other people, you know. It's not just about getting published. I mean, I guess I felt, it's interesting. Once you start publishing, you sort of forget sometimes, I think, that you really are writing to reach people and that it's really not so much about the publication, but it's awesome if, you know, somebody in, you know, North Carolina just read your story. Even if you get rejected, it's really great to know that someone looked at it, or you hope that someone has looked at it. And I want to give everybody that opportunity to know that I actually read your work. Even if you get rejected, I did read it. The editor of the magazine did read it, not maybe an intern who just decides after, you know, one sentence, oh, rejected, this isn't going to work, you know. And I think it's almost like if it's read, somehow that makes that person's universe better, even if they don't know it's actually happened. If that makes sense.
Well, I believe you told me earlier that you actually respond to every email that you get.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's...
Yeah, if anybody ever contacts Palooka, I'm the one who responds on the contact form, or when they contact the main Palooka address, I respond to everything. Sometimes, of course, if people are trying to instigate me because of something we do, I don't respond to that because I think that's pointless. But if someone has a genuine question or they have a comment or anything, I always respond to everybody. And I've even written pages to people. I think I was telling you this, who I've had some people write me saying that they were super frustrated. They'd sent a couple stories to me and they'd been rejected, or, you know, they'll actually, based on my mission statement for Palooka, they will write and say, you know, I know no other magazine would consider answering this question or this plea that I have. And they will send it to me after having read my mission statement, feeling like I would actually listen to them. And I do. And then I write them back and I give them advice, because I know what that was like. I know how hard it is to be submitting this work. Even sometimes people yell at you for having rejected their work, but I still understand that feeling of being so upset that you feel like you're putting yourself out there. And I know how hard that is, because I've done it myself for a pretty long time now. And I just feel for that, for those people, because I'm one of them. We're always kind of one of them. I've been published in some pretty decent places, and I get rejected almost, I don't know, probably 5 times a week. You know, I get rejected all the time. So I think at least the point I'm at in my writing career, I'm still getting rejected a lot. And I understand how that feels still. So I want to do everything I can to, I really legitimately started Palooka completely for people. I just really wanted to help anybody who's been in the positions that I had been in and give as much as I can to them. I put Palooka in front of everything else, period. It's even in front of my own writing. I do Palooka before I do anything. So,
well, with my podcast, it's sort of up in the air whether I'm putting this in front of my writing. Some days, yes, but I'm not sure. Yeah, it's a work in progress. I do recall, yeah, it's one of those things that's going into the lore, I think, of the writing life, which is those rejection slips. I know I had, probably 750 rejection slips before I got my first acceptance. And I was euphoric when Turn Row accepted my story, Guy Psycho. I mean, you know, it's a literary magazine. I think they paid me a small stipend.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just the fact that, and it was a really interesting story, actually. The editor there, Bill Ryan, liked the story so much that, you know, they had actually wrapped the issue.
Wow.
And he said, no, I love this. And he bought a case of beer and went over to the other editor's house and read the story aloud while the other editor drank the beer. And mine is the last story in the issue, because they had basically laid out the issue and they decided they would squeeze me in there because they liked what they saw. And
incredible. Tell me the name again of that magazine.
Turn Row out of University of Louisiana, Lafayette, I believe. No.
Wow.
Monroe?
That's just one of those good stories that you like to hear, you know?
Well, and it kind of takes someone to champion you. And so one of the things that really pleases me about your magazine is, you know, that's sort of the way you're approaching the magazine, is you want to approach first the work and then you champion the writer. And you also have a really interesting approach to the contributor section, where you let people have their author bios, where you I remember being a little bit surprised when you asked for mine. And what was it that you were looking for?
I'm looking for in bios.
Yeah.
Well, wait, so were you saying you were surprised because I actually wanted a bio from you?
No, because you wanted the non-standard bio, right? The standard bio is basically a resume.
Yeah, you know, and that has a lot to do with, like I had explained earlier about the cover letters that I had said on some mishmash. It's that same kind of thing where I really care about people and the person, and I want them, actually, and that's the thing, is I don't want the magazine to, you know, sometimes I feel like the magazine overshadows the people somehow, and the writers, the artists, like, I want it to be the opposite. That's why I want photographs. I want them to tell their story. A lot of people still like to do the standard bio. I don't know if maybe they feel more comfortable that way. Maybe they want to present themselves in what they see as a more professional way. And it's not, I don't think it's unprofessional to be more, I don't know, conversational in your bio, but I find those the most fascinating. There are people, you know, who write little mini stories in their bios that are just excellent. And I just love how much it's interesting. You can have your work, and then you can also have, it's like you have a work version of yourself. Here are your two poems, and then it's, you know, but then here's Mike. It's like a different voice. I can almost hear that person's voice, and that person shows through. Not that it doesn't in the work. We have so many different voices we use. It's awesome to be able to actually hear their sort of, I don't want to call it a human voice, but, you know, their actual person voice. And then you could see the person. And some people don't want their pictures, I understand that. But it's really great to be able to offer those options, at least, that you know, even with the pictures, I say, you know, you can do that kind of, like, studio photograph, or you can do some sort of, like, here's me, you know, like, mowing my lawn, you know, or whatever. It's just really interesting then the pictures that people choose to represent themselves. So I think it's like three ways basically to represent yourself through the work, through the photo, and through the personal bio. So I think that's really great. It's very difficult for me if I read a literary magazine that actually has no bios at all, because I don't understand that. I don't understand why not give a couple extra pages. It's not going to cost them any more money. I don't know if it's because it's more work. I'm not really sure. But I just love giving people that opportunity. I actually had a question about something you said. Can I ask you a question about something you said before?
I guess that's allowed.
Am I allowed to ask a question?
Yeah.
You'd said after you had about 750 rejections, you got, this is Turnrail, right? That was your first acceptance?
Yes.
And you said you were euphoric. So I know you've had quite a lot after that. So my question for you is, how do you feel now when you get an acceptance? What's it like for you now?
Well, I feel like it's never enough.
Mm-hmm.
Which I guess makes me an addict, but... You know, I have a novel manuscript, and if I get representation for that, or if I get that published, you know, with a reputable house, then I will be euphoric once again.
Yeah.
I think, I expect, right. You know, it's hard to know exactly how you'll feel, but a lot of the sort of successes of the writing life don't feel the way you thought they would.
Yeah.
I remember.
Do you think if you... You know, and I know your book will do well. I mean, you're so talented, but do you think that if... You, let's say you do publish, and you said it was a novel manuscript, right?
Yeah.
Now, if you publish your novel and, you know, then like, let's say you get another one and another one and another one, don't you think probably by the second, third, or fourth, those might become similar to your literary magazine publications where you start to feel that kind of, okay, what's the next thing I can accomplish that'll make me euphoric again?
Well, I think, you know, and I think we're in different situations as writers. Which we'll get into later, I think, when we talk about your vagabonding. But, you know, right now I'm just hauling so much ass trying to make a living that, you know, if I could get the book published, that means I could get a decent creative writing job.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so actually a lot of my concerns are attached to a lot of the things that I think you deeply dislike about the writing life and about literary conventions is, well, okay, you go through these rules, you jump through these hoops when... You know, like if I didn't have to get a better job teaching, and by better job, I just mean, you know, a better paying job. If I could get a better paying job, then, you know, so many other things in my life would improve, including having a reasonable amount of time to write in, which I don't really have now. You know, all the time I write in now is just sort of stolen. So for me, you know, there are certain plateaus. And they're not necessarily about the writing. You know, plateau one, all right, getting my novel published. Plateau two, getting a decent job. And plateau three might be retiring. I don't know. Like, I have a lot of books left in me that I desperately want to write. I think if I could get a decent job, you know, I might actually, what would make me feel euphoric is just getting to spend time on my writing and not feeling like, you know, my entire life is a blur where every time I write something long that I'm sort of stealing time away from some other responsibility.
Wow. That is such a rough thing to feel like when you're doing what you love, you feel guilty because you're not doing the thing you have to do.
Yeah. I mean, so if I could pay my bills mm-hmm. with more regularity and calm, like that would be just an extraordinary accomplishment for me.
You know, it's such a... This is why I really respect artists and, you know, writers and people who are doing creative things, because it's like, you know, it's such a challenge, because I feel like, you know, people who don't understand that world, who don't do artistic things or creative things, it's like, I mean, these are things you have to do. You have to do them. It's not something you cannot do. But I feel like people who don't have that kind of passion for these kinds of things, they kind of, you know, they have their work life and then all this other time to kind of do it, you know what I mean? I mean, it's like there isn't that other insane drive to do these things you're really passionate about. Whereas if you're a writer, it's like, it's almost like you have several, I don't want to say jobs, but you have several, it's in a way you do. I mean, you're thinking about it all the time, and then you have to do your job to, you know, survive. But this is like another job in itself, but you love it and you hate it. And it's such a It's a real rough balance to maintain, I found. But see, you seem like one of those people who really does write often or really wishes you could write often. Does that sound accurate? That is what you're saying. That is what you're saying, I think. It's interesting. I write in my head all the time. I'm always thinking about this. Always, always, always. I actually do my best. It's interesting. I actually have written pieces in the shower in my head, or at least portions of them. And then, you know, you go and sit down and you sort of actually write it for real. It's obviously not verbatim at all. But I really do not actually sit down and write that much. I just, when I do write, I seem to have whatever that is that I needed to do to sort of absorb or be out in the world and experience whatever. It's just like, it's just kind of like I vomited it out and there it is. You know, that's, and I think I'm fortunate to be able to do it in this way, because I don't actually spend nearly as much time as I know so many other people I've met who write or who are artists or whatever do. They spend so many hours. And I really don't actually that often, which I think is interesting.
Well, and it probably comes down to some important life choices. And, you know, Grace Paley, part of her advice to writers and students was keep a low overhead. And I flunked that test. But, you know, I wind up, how can I put this? I know when I have certain windows of time to write in, and I sort of hold my panic until I get to those times, because I can't write every day. I simply can't. You know, there are days when I leave early in the morning, I get home early in the evening, and by the time I'm done with dinner, like, I'm ready to go to bed, and my creative energies just aren't there. So I have several projects in my head that I'm working on all the time. And when words start sprouting up there, you know, then I make sure that I write them down so that I don't lose them. And so, you know, and occasionally I find myself like those sprouts. Okay, that winds up being a page or four pages by the time I'm done typing it in. You know, so I just have to keep all these sort of lines open, but I really can't focus on finishing anything until I get to those windows of time. Like right this second, when this airs, it won't be true, but right this second, right, I'm in between the summer term and the fall term of teaching. And that was 2 weeks long, and I've had lots of things to interrupt me, but I'm actually getting some writing done right now. But I sort of have to aim the catastrophe to the right place in situations
and
like this.
That's what I find so interesting about so many people who just, you know, I guess, go into this creative field. Your degree or your experience points you toward becoming a teacher. But in order to do that, I guess to sustain yourself, so you, let's say you become a teacher, and then so much of your energy is spent on this stuff, you know, in the teaching and then the grading and, you know, doing the papers and all of that stuff and the office hours. And then, you know, so you're using that in order to be able to kind of have hopefully some free time in order to write. And of course, it's nice to be able to talk about English and creative writing and all this stuff, but then it also kind of inhibits you from writing. I mean, because you have to spend so much with it. It can be a very mentally and physically exhausting job. I've talked to so many people who become teachers or do adjunct work after, you know, getting their MFA or whatever, and then they stop. They just stop altogether. They just don't write anymore. And it's just so interesting that you go into this field thinking, oh, I love creative writing, I love to write, I love to do these things, and then that leads you to this track where then a lot of times you can't even continue with the thing that brought you there in the first place because, you know, you're so occupied with all this stuff. So I don't know, I just find that really interesting, and it always frustrates me. It's always, and that's actually why I never pursued I'd like to at some point maybe pursue the teaching. I don't know, as you know, my life's a little up in the air in a way, but it's also not. It's super focused on this thing I've dreamed of doing and will be doing. But that is my frustration for me going out to people, you know, like you who are really pursuing this thing. You want to publish this novel and hope it does really well and then get a job, a higher paying job, hopefully a better job where you can hopefully teach less or teach more of the creative stuff or teach to graduate students. And then,
well, my long-term goal, and I've said this for at least a decade, I would just like to get paid a little bit more and teach a little bit less.
Yeah,
if I could get that, I would be thrilled. I don't expect an easy life, but if it could just be a little bit less difficult and if a little bit more comfortable, I would be thrilled.
And here's one thing I kind of just wondered it now, but for a long time I've wondered about this. I've never been a scheduled writer. I know pretty much everybody I've ever known, except for maybe a couple people who write, or they are what I don't know how to call it anything. It's almost like I'm saying scheduled writers, or they write like it's a job.
Yeah.
And I've And I think that always seemed very weird to me, but so many people believe that's how it's done, that you say, okay, from, 8 a.m. to noon, I'm going to write these 3 days of the week, or from, 4 to 6 or whatever. That's always been very, very strange to me, because in a way, it seems to me like it takes the... I'm much more of a... At least for me, this is the way it's always worked. I don't know how I would phrase it. I guess it's like an inspiration... No, that doesn't even work. I write when... I write when I'm moved to do it. I don't know if that's the muse thing or whatever. I always am writing in my mind. I'm always thinking in stories. I'm always thinking in poetics and in lines, just lines. Like, I'll get this one great line and I'll just hit save it in my brain. I've never, ever scheduled writing. I remember one of my professors in my MFA had told me that I needed to schedule my writing. That's something I do. He actually, quote-unquote, prescribed that to me if he were a writing doctor. but I did great without it. It's just not my way. And I don't know if that's a way to get people. I don't understand it. I don't know if it's just a way because a lot of people do end up not writing anymore, or if it's because it actually helped, this thing started because of what you're talking about, how you have these jobs, for instance, like this teaching job, where you just don't have time, and so it's like you have got to carve out okay, this hour here, this hour here. I don't know what it is. I don't know which came before the other, or if that's just a way. You see, because a lot of people say to me, oh, it's just like athletic, you have to train for it. You have to train. I actually don't believe that. I don't believe, personally, I don't really honestly think that, I don't think that, I'm not saying you don't get better when you write, but I really don't believe that writing like 4 hours a day is going to make you that much better. I really don't. I think it's very similar to because I've had compared to athletics, but if you were an average sprinter, and you sprinted every day for half an hour sessions every day, you're never going to be an Olympic sprinter. It's not going to happen. You don't have that gift. And I really think writing is very similar. I definitely think you can get better. You can improve, for instance, in running. You can improve your form, your mechanics, all the technical aspects. And that's the same with writing. But if you just kind of don't have that one, that it quality, I don't think all that writing is actually going to push you to that, let's just say, Olympic level. I think you're where you are, and you might get better on the technical side of things, but I really just think some people have that gift. Some people have just been able to run 100 meters in under 10 seconds. That's just their gift, and I think working is very similar in that way, at least from what I've experienced with my own work and how other people work. I've seen people who write for literally, I'm making 4 hours a day, and they have these aspirations that I understand you have certain aspirations to get somewhere, but I just don't necessarily believe that it's all in the time you're putting into the actual act of writing. I think so much of it, at least from how I've done things, is I think you really have to pay attention to the world. I think you just really have to watch the world, and that those artistic types have that way of seeing things and seeing details and looking at the world in angles that other people just don't look at the world. And I think that is the most important thing, because after all, you're writing about the world. But I think so many people get so stuck in the idea that it's got to be hours a day, and they actually aren't getting out into that world, the real world, that we're supposed to be portraying. And yeah. I also think, obviously, reading what you love, I think is really helpful. And then I also think it is helpful to read what the literary magazines, and read sort of what the trends are, and just see, okay, well, what are people doing nowadays? And that doesn't mean you have to follow the trend. It's just nice to know what's out there. I know I actually, my fiction is a very sort of antiquated style of fiction. Or maybe it's not. I don't know. I'm a huge Raymond Carver fan, Ethan Kanan. I very much write in, I'd say it's almost a blend of their style. I don't know. I'm my own voice and everything, but I mean, I've always really looked up to those guys, Tom Jones, Dennis Johnson, those kinds of writers. Anyhow, I just went on a long tangent there. You have anything to say about that? I don't know where that came from.
Well, you were talking about the advice that writers are given to keep a writing schedule. And I've been given that advice both by Jonathan Lethem, who was a teacher of mine, and also by Garrison Keillor, who said, wake up at 6, turn off the internet, turn off the phone, and write. And he's cranking out books, and he's an older gentleman with a full-time job hosting a pretty good radio program once a week.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so I think, first of all, there's no absolute advice that anyone can give and say, this is absolutely good advice. No advice works for everybody. is what I found. But I think the idea behind the advice is it's so easy just not to write.
Yep.
And your life is going to clobber the shit out of you. So if you've got a 9-to-5 job, you're not going to write it at work. You're not going to write it after work. But if you care about it, then you need to get up early and put in an hour or two.
Yeah.
And if you do that, then you can get it done. Now, if you're lucky, you don't have a 9-to-5 job.
Right, right.
But also, this is one of the ways that you can make sure, if you're working on a long project, that you can actually get that done. And there's one other upside to a writing schedule, and I'm not being dogmatic about this in any way, but, you know, some writers do get obsessed with how much they're writing. And I think that is dangerous. I'm writing 4 pages a day, goddammit. And I'm, you know, and then when you can't, then you wind up having a panic attack, or you start beating yourself up like, oh God, I'm never going to get this done. I didn't write my 4 pages today. And I think if you observe the time, I'm going to give myself 2 hours today and let's see what I can do, you know. And as long as you give yourself the time to write, you know, I think we're not in control of this process. You know, Stephen King in On Writing says, people ask them, you know, where they get their ideas from, and writers know that they don't know where they get their ideas from.
Yep.
And so I think observing the time can be really important.
I do understand that. I actually read On Writing several years ago, and I was actually very impressed with a lot of what he had to say. I completely agree, actually, and what you were saying about how there's no, and that's the most interesting thing to me about this whole thing, is you can write these stories that you're just, you even read them and you go, where did I get this from? I mean, it's just this weird thing that's inside of you, you know? It's almost like we really have lived these other lives, and these stories are just, they're trying to get out of us, you know? But I think what I see as problematic is that that pressure is, I think you're right, so many people put pressure on themselves, but even with the time, I think the problem is, I've been told by people who are writers, if you want to, you know, that I'm not a writer because I don't write every day, or I'm not a writer because I don't have a schedule.
Which is really, fucking rubbish.
Really, yeah. Well, it's interesting, and that's what I mean is you...
You're not a writer if you don't keep a journal. You're not a writer. Yeah, it's all fucking bullshit.
Well, you know, I agree. It's interesting, though, because, you know, some of the least talented writers I've ever met, and, you know, they journaled, they took notes, they set up writing schedules, they read everything they were supposed to read. And this is why I'm saying you can do all that stuff, but I think a lot of times it just comes down to gifts. You were given something, you weren't. You had it, you didn't. You know, and you can always improve. But I think people believe, and I think it's very false, that just by doing this as much as you possibly can, or scheduling or whatever, that you're going to hit that like New Yorker level. And I don't buy that at all. I don't at all believe that. It's just, I think it's problematic is that it, at least from what I've experienced in my undergrad creative writing and then my MFA, is that the idea is this is the only way. It's this way. And if you don't do it this way, you're wrong. And I mean, I've already proved that wrong, I feel like, based on how I do things. But so many people buy into this propaganda or this sort of zombie-like mentality of this is how, you know, this is how writers should be. This is what writers do.
Yeah.
You get, you know, you just kind of get that stuff implanted into you that all that time. And it never fit for me. I think once I tried to do this whole scheduling thing, and it was so forced. Everything I couldn't even really do it because I'm just not one of those people. I do what I'm inspired to do. And I probably honestly write about maybe one piece every month or two, maybe. I don't worry. I really don't worry about it. Occasionally, it's rare, but occasionally I'll go like, oh, I really should be, you know, but it's weird. Where's that coming from? I really should be writing something down. It's weird because every day I develop sentences, stories, essays, poems, plays, all that stuff. I'm doing that all in my head. They're bits of everything, you know, and I think that's great. I think it's because you're still doing it. It's just not, it's kind of like, you know, going to see something magnificent. And you don't bring a camera. Well, just because you didn't take a picture of it. That doesn't mean it wasn't there. That doesn't mean you didn't have the experience. It was still very beautiful to you. And I have moments like that all the time. And I have a lot of those. Like I was saying, strangely, when I'm in the shower, I just get these. I don't know why. I just, you know, my father and I both have talked about this. For whatever reason, you know, we have this time in the shower. And maybe it's because where we think at our best, and it's probably because you have all of the distractions gone, and it's just you, and you're in there, and mm-hmm. it's just this. I actually feel like it's like a time of meditation for me. But yeah, I just think all I'm kind of asking for is I wish it was more about balance. I wish it was more about like, yeah, maybe you should try and schedule some time, but then also be accepting of the fact that maybe it's okay to go out there in the real world and actually spend time out in the world and not write anything. It's okay to just go experience, because if you don't go experience, how are you really going to know what you're writing anyway? I mean, it's interesting. I'll read published stories, and you can sort of tell that these people have never experienced what they're writing about. It's just so false. And it's not like I'm saying you have to have experienced what you're writing, but I'm saying it's very clear to me, at least when I read work, and these people aren't going out and doing things. They're just sitting there writing. Because you know what I mean when you're reading a fictitious world versus a world that's kind of – the literary world is strange because a lot of it's definitely not real, but a lot of it's definitely the truth. And you can just feel it. It doesn't have to be – you know, nonfiction that you're writing is fiction. I just mean, you know, the difference between someone who's legitimately out there and someone who's in a room practicing essentially 4 hours a day or whatever you want to call it, their training, you know. And I've just never been partial to that training style of writing. I've been much more partial to, like I said, a balance. It'd be great if people could just strike a balance, I'm trying to say.
Well, I think it's important for writers to try out everything, but not everything's going to work for them.
Yeah, and you're right. There is no answer. It's just something I really wish we would talk more about in general, because you know there is no answer. You definitely have to. It's just like your diet. You got to do what works for you and your body and how you respond to it. I just don't. And I'm not saying it's wrong. I don't think the schedule thing is wrong. I think it's wrong though that we just, like, you know, the MFA professors are constantly saying this is the way to do it. This is the way to do it. All the books are saying you have to do it this way. You have to. I've never read a book. I really haven't. I've never read a book or about how it's okay to not have that schedule, how it's okay to go for these long periods of time. It's weird. We all, you know, people write about writer's block and the dread of not writing and all that stuff. And I really just don't dread that stuff, because I know it will happen when it needs to happen. I really don't think there's a lot of writers out there who are comfortable and okay with that. And I wish that there was a way to untrain them from feeling that dread, you know, that they've been in, that it's been instilled in them, you know. And I don't think it's purely a, oh, you know, this was, you know, put into them kind of thing. But I think a lot of times there's that expectation. And when we don't meet expectations, you know, we start to think, oh, no, something's wrong with me, you know.
Yeah.
Because even that's still occasionally, not that often, but does occasionally slip into me, like, what am I doing wrong here? I'm sure I know, you know, other people are writing books that day. You know what I mean? Like you and your novel that you have coming out, or hopefully.
I'm
sure you just whipped that up yesterday.
So.
Sorry, that was another tangent for you. So,
Well, partly I did feel that euphoria again when Palooka picked up my two poems, because I felt differently about the poems than I did about my fiction. Like my fiction, I felt like I was very confident in what I was doing. And the poems, no one had recognized that yet. And for me, they were pretty autobiographical, and I wasn't really accustomed to putting myself out there quite like that.
Yeah.
And so when, you know, you sent me that email, yeah, I did my cakewalk. I was awfully, awfully happy when that happened.
Can I comment on your poems real quick?
Sure.
Yeah, you know what's interesting is I think I told you. I mean, I really love those poems from the beginning, and I've read them several times. Actually, every time I go through Palooka 2, I actually end up reading those, because I just really, really love those poems. And what was really super fascinating to me is I know that not everyone writes poems in that sort of nonfiction way, where it's like, yes, this is really my life or whatever. But I had that feeling, I really did. And I just read them again days ago. And I had that feeling when I was reading them, like you were just saying, I had this very, and it's probably what moved me so much about them, but I was like, man, I really feel this. I can really feel this, especially with Spinning. I was just like, I'm a huge sucker for father-son work, and I just love that, the dynamic in that piece, and just, I don't know, I really could feel that. I really could, I don't know, I haven't read your fiction, but there was just something so personally connective about it that I really, really enjoyed. It's, I don't know. I actually feel like those were maybe the first, trying to think about that issue, but I feel like those might have been some of the first poems we took for that issue. But I do love the fact that you get that feeling, because I know when I've published my play and I recently published some poetry, those are not my field. And it was so rewarding to be like, wow, I can do this too, you know? And is that kind of like what you were expressing with those? Oh, well, and of course that you were actually putting a lot of yourself out there with those poems.
One of my first great humanitarian acts was to stop writing poetry when I was an undergraduate. And so it was only in the last few years when I've started writing poetry again, you know, in a much less self-indulgent way. But I really was risking looking like an ass by just talking about things that maybe seem sentimental or goofy. But yeah, I mean, Evel Knievel as sort of a metaphor in a poem is certainly bucking against the literary establishment. Don't see that going in the New Yorker anytime soon.
It's so interesting though, because I just don't pick things. It's so funny. I mean, I really do not ever, I don't feel like I've made any decision, especially about picking work, where I'm going, okay, general literary establishment is not going to pick this, I'm going to pick it. It just happens that, you know, and I swear to God, those poems could have made it into, you know, much better known higher journals for sure, but they fit perfectly in mine. And that's, you know, it's very interesting. Anyway, so when I read that work, that stuff just appeals to me. And it's not even like, and that's what I'm saying, it really is good enough and definitely. Other journals certainly would have wanted to take that right away. It's just, I think you recognize that it's just, there's some kind of fit there, and you hit my aesthetic perfectly. And I just find that really, really fascinating. The whole, this idea that like somehow my choices, I don't know why, they just sort of go against. And I think it's just, I'm a different thinker. I really think in a different kind of way. The way, like we've discussed, my writing style, the way I write, the way I compose in my head, the things I do. We all write, we all come up with ideas in our mind, of course, but I think a lot of people work those out on the paper, and I never do that ever. I pretty much somehow, and it's not like I'm sitting here constructing an entire essay in my head, but I take a line and I save it, and then I, you know, I don't know, once I sit down, I literally just put that thing down on paper, and that's it. That's the final thing. Of everything I've ever published, the final thing came out in my first draft. You obviously have to like put some editing into it, but I mean, I almost never have to modify or change anything that's of any kind of like, you know, on the larger scale of like, oh, this whole section has to move here and this whole thing has to move there and we have to cut this entire thing. And why? I'm able to somehow tweak in my head just while it's going, and then that's just my way. So anyway, I just think in a very different way. I think I have a different aesthetic. I'm just open to all kinds of things. I mean, you've gone through the book, you know that it's not just things that, I mean, there's some very traditional stuff in there too. There's some, you know, kind of experimental work. No, I think Marcia Aldrich's piece is in your issue also, the one where she's the teacher's grading the test. Do you remember that one?
Not offhand, no. Sorry.
Okay. Well, it's where literally it's a short story where it's a test that a student has. It's basically the story is within the answers the student has given in this test.
And
it's literally written like a test. It looks like a test. And there's this great story about this girl, her kind of messed up family life, just through her answers in this test. It's just so interesting. But anyway, yeah, I don't know why I'm drawn to this kind of stuff. But again, I don't sit here and question it. I don't sit here and try and figure out why. I really just make decisions based on how I feel about things.
Well, and when I said, you know, oh, this goes against the literary establishment, I don't mean to suggest that that's all it takes to please
right,
you.
Right.
That's
no,
like...
And, you know, I know you definitely didn't mean that. Sometimes I think people do look at the site and think, I've never been published, they're definitely going to publish me because I've never been published. Or, you know, oh, I'm doing this thing that's totally different, they're going to take it. You can't make any kind of guesses like that or bets like that when it comes to submitting anything.
No, it has to be good work. And, you know, I think you have to really risk, you know, putting your heart out there. And so merely experimental work or radical work isn't automatically good.
Right, totally. And I think that's the thing, too, when you look at all this stuff in Palooka, everything, it's definitely risking that. It's oh my gosh, in your book especially, in number two, there are just so many things in there that are just, for me, very heartbreaking And again, with Born and Spinning, that's why I think those two really stood out to me too, because you really are risking things in there. Even if not true or fully true or whatever, and you had said that you were risking a lot for yourself, and of course I wouldn't have known that having read through it, but you still have to risk something no matter what, even if you're writing a short story, because all of what you write is still you. That's still you doing this, you know? I think our true selves really come out of our writing, even if it's fiction. They're just things, our fantasies or our fears or the things we love. I mean, they're all in there, you know? So, I don't know. And I really appreciated that about that work, for sure. Always fun to go through and read those again.
And so the sort of opportunity that you're giving writers like myself and my fellow contributors to Palooka, you're giving them an even bigger opportunity with your chatbot contest. So tell us about that, please.
Segues. That was just one of those things. I'm always wanting to give more as much as possible. I'm always trying to give more. So I just decided, why not be a press too? Why not do a chapbook every year? And with the chapbook, I didn't want it to just be. And the way I thought about it is, it's really great to have a spot in the magazine. It's really great. But I wanted to offer something bigger, because I've read some pieces, some poems, some essays, some stories, you know, graphic work. And I just was like, man, I would love to be able to give more to somebody, like give them a whole book's worth, you know. And of course, it's a chapbook, so it's not a full book, because a lot of people don't have necessarily a full book's worth waiting around that they want to offer to a literary magazine's press or whatever. But I thought, you know, 35 to 50 pages was a perfect way to, and, you know, it's multi-genre, it's fiction, essays, nonfiction, poetry, but it's pretty much everything, graphic work, drama. Because, I mean, writers of plays just don't have a place either. You know, I was lucky that Third Coast picked up my play, because there are very few places to submit. And, God, it would just be so neat to, if you had a handful of 10-minute plays that you wanted to get published, or 5-minute plays or whatever, you know, it would just be neat. So, yeah, I'm just trying to offer an opportunity again where it doesn't have to be so specific as, like, it's, you know, just, you know, 50-page chapbook of only poetry or whatever. I really wanted to give as many people the opportunity to get their work out there. And like I said, I'm going to read everything, all of it, every piece. So, yeah, I'm really, really, really excited about it. And I'm going to be distributing or giving the winner, I think there's 20 copies and $100, and definitely promoting them a lot on our Facebook page and on our homepage. And I'm really, really, really excited about it. It's just, I don't know, I'm really super excited about it. We just started, was it a month ago or something? So yeah, so that's why I started that, to give people another chance to get themselves out there, but in a different way, not just the magazine. And everything is also, each piece is also considered for the magazine, so even if they didn't get the publication for the book, maybe they would end up in the magazine.
And the deadline's in December?
Yeah, right now the deadline is set for December. Of course, as you know, some of it's going to have to do with my travels and where I end up and how good my access for internet and stuff like that is. But right now, yeah, it's December. What is it? December 1st? Is that right?
I seem to recall December 2nd.
I really should know this, but I made the page a while ago.
One of us should know this.
Definitely the one on this side of the phone.
And I cannot get my mouse to cooperate.
That's okay. You know, if they end up going to the site, they can easily find it there.
Well, let's talk about your travels.
Yeah.
So I just read your latest entry, and I found it really, really moving. But before we talk about that, let's start at the beginning. Mm-hmm. What started the vagabonding?
Well, as you can tell, I guess I don't usually exactly follow the – I don't know. I mean, I for most of my life, I followed that regular sort of track, I guess, that I would say kind of average, I would say Americans sort of end up on, where it's, you know, you go to grade school, and then you go to high school, and then nowadays it seems like almost everyone is going to college and you get a bachelor's degree. And then I think a lot of people are like confused, you know, what do I do now? So I have a bachelor's degree, do I go get a master's? And ever since I was a child, I just did not, it's interesting because I always, you know, kids are always like, I don't want to go to school, I want to stay home and play. You know, I had more of like I would ask my dad why I'm going to school, but it was much more of I just kind of want to understand the reasoning behind why I'm going to school to do all these tasks that even as a child I felt like were just busy work. I just didn't understand it. A lot of times I felt like I wasn't learning. I felt like I was just doing things to keep me occupied. And that was frustrating to me.
That's because you were just doing things to keep occupied. Oh, that was because you were just doing things to keep occupied much of the time.
And the thing is, what they tell you is that you're going to get an education. And you are. You definitely are, in a way. But that always bothered me. But I did it. You know, that's what you would have seen. What are you going to do? You don't know any other outlets. In college, halfway through college, I just really had that same feeling of, this isn't for me. I don't understand this. Why am I even doing this? This isn't even something I'm interested in. You know, I'm getting a bachelor's degree so that I can what? So that I can get a job that I'm sort of okay with, maybe, or maybe I really don't like it, but then so what? So I can make some money, so then I can live that, well, whatever that idea of the American dream is. I don't even know what that really is. I mean, I feel like it's, so I guess ever since what I started recognizing is that, you know, kind of ever since you're born, you're put onto this track, and if you follow this track, you're going to, you know, everything will be great, and this is the life you want. You know, you're always told this is the life you want, and then you're going to go, you know, get married at like 23 or 24 or whatever, and then you have two kids, and then you own a house, and then you have a mortgage, and you work these, you know, 5 jobs, and that never appealed to me. I think I tried. It was kind of like when I tried to be religious for all those years. My mom really wanted me to be a Christian and everything. I really tried. I felt nothing of it. I really tried. And ever since I was little, real little kid, I think I was reading the Bible at like 10, you know, and I read through the whole thing a couple times, and I just really didn't understand. It didn't feel like it applied. There's something I really struggled with, is when people are telling you these are the things you need to do, and then you just, they don't move you at all. And you see a lot of contradictions and hypocrisy in those worlds. And so I left that behind. And then I was trying to figure out a way to leave behind that sort of tracked life. And I just didn't know how to do it. My dad and I, in 2010, traveled to Europe. I hadn't been there. He took me as a child, actually. And I remember just really loving it, but you're so small. I was 8 years old. And then, so I was 25 or 26, and we went again. And it was just immediately when I stepped out, we went from the airport in Rome to the train station. And immediately when I stepped out, I had that same, like, that same feeling I get when I read a piece that just blows me away, like an amazing piece when I'm reading submissions. And I felt home. It was the first time I ever felt like I was at home in my entire life, like really at home. Like, I really dislike big cities, but it might just be American big cities. I'm really unsure, because when I was there, I was just blown away. And it was just this feeling. I wasn't even in some, you know, I wasn't like standing at the Vatican or in front of the Pantheon or something. I was just on some side street, and it was just this feeling. And then we traveled for about 3 or 4 weeks, and I don't know. It's just so hard to explain. I really don't know that I can explain it other than there's this magnificent feeling. And then when I came back, I just had a hard time adjusting to the lifestyle here. And then I went back again. I think I went in the span of about 2 years, I think I went a year and a half or so. I went back like 5 times. And I just started realizing I've got to find a way to live a life where I'm constantly being. And here's the thing I guess I was going to say. I feel kind of like I think you can reach an age. I believe as Americans, at least, we reach this age of, and I say Americans because I've never lived anywhere else. I don't know what it's necessarily like living elsewhere. Hence, I would love to, I'm doing what I'm doing. But I think you reach this age of about 11, 12, going on 13, something like that, where it's almost like society drives you away from creativity. I feel like they drive you away from doing those innocent sort of things, and they drive you toward, okay, you have grades now, you need to do really well with that, you need to, like, do, you know, I got a job when I was, like, 13 or 14, you know, it's like, some people are getting jobs, some people have to do really well in school, some people are driven at these athletic endeavors, they start treating you like a really young adult in a way, and they put you further away from the constant sort of new stimulus and the I feel like the more innocent version of yourself, to this, like, adult, okay, this is the real world, you got to deal with it, kind of, like, track or whatever. And it's just what I wanted. So basically, between, I would say, the ages of 13 and I'm going to be 29 in a few days, actually, for all that time, so it's like 16 years, I felt like if I wanted to learn, I really had to go out on my own and do it. And I did, because that's the kind of person I am. I was just constantly learning and reading, like, philosophy and reading about history and reading about science. And I love, like, time travel and just, you know, just reading about all these really interesting theories and fascinating stuff. But I felt like to really get a different kind of education, you also have to go out in a world that's not in this bubble. You have to go out and experience worlds that you don't understand and that might make you a little nervous. And so what I wanted was, I realized when I was overseas that that I was like a child again. It was like you don't know the language, you don't know the where you're going. You know, there's constantly, wait a minute, so this is how they drive, they're over here, this is how the signs work. Like, it's just like I felt like this amazing sense of, wow, I'm learning again, and I'm learning in a totally different way. And, you know, and I'm there. It's not like I'm reading about it in a book or seeing it on a video. It's like you're really there experiencing that stimuli. And that is what I think I'd been missing since I was a child. I think that's where somehow I lost. I think we all lose this over time. And I think everybody accepts it as, well, you know, this is just what happens. You get older and you have to do these things. You have to work this kind of job. And if you want to do these things, you have to do these things. And, you know, people accept those kinds of, I guess I was never willing to accept the fact that I lost that innocence is just kind of gone, and that sort of joy is kind of gone, and that version of happiness, that newness is gone. And I don't know, once I started traveling like that, it was there. And I'm sure it will definitely fade in places, but I want to do everything I can to go after a life that I really think I'm going to love, where I'm going to be couch surfing, staying in hostels, hitchhiking, working help exchanges where I'm getting food and a place to stay in exchange for, you know, doing labor of some sort, but not like 40 hours a week. A lot of them are between 10 and 30 hours a week. Some are like 4 days a week. They all completely vary, but you're basically breaking even in a sense. You know, a lot of what I've been reading about or had read about, there's a book called Vagabonding, which is amazing. And when I read that, it was like, okay, so I'm not crazy. You can really do this. And that's part of, like, sort of like with Palooka, where I really wanted to help people in the literary realm and the art realm and stuff like that get out there. With this, I'm doing this absolutely for myself, and, you know, just to get to a point where I'm really happy and I'm loving what I'm doing and feeling like I'm really, really alive and learning every day in an environment, in different environments that I think are going to be super challenging to who I am. I also want to help with my Vagabond website and with Afterward. I really just want to help people understand you can go and get those things you want. I mean, I was a bodybuilder for a while. I was a personal trainer. I did boxing. I worked as a bouncer. I, you know, started writing, did the creative writing, got an MFA, started my own literary magazine. Now I'm, you know, doing this vagabonding thing, starting my own blog, my own Facebook page. All this. It's like you really can go and, like, do all these different things. You just have to be willing to make some sacrifices and just realize you can do things you've dreamed about doing. And I think all my life, this is the life I wanted. This is the life I wanted where it's like I'm constantly learning. One other thing I wanted to say that I think you'll really appreciate is that I really have always wanted to live more than my one life. And a lot of people's one life, I think, is following what you're sort of, that track they put you, you're sort of put on from the get-go. And I think a lot of people, like, let's say, end up being an insurance agent from the age of 28 to 65 or whatever. You know, you stay in this sort of same kind of realm, working these jobs that you might be okay with, but, you know, you've got your 2 weeks of vacation a year and all that stuff. I want to live lots of different lives. I want to go and work on, you know, at a seaweed factory in Ireland, like a friend of mine actually has done for a month. And then I want to, you know, go live in Italy and pick olives, or, you know, then go and live in, I don't know, Greece for a while and go to Cyprus for a while. And every time I was traveling, I was just looking at all these different people when I passed by and think, wow, I wonder what that life is like. And I think as writers, that is what you're doing. You're just doing it on the page. I want to go and do it. I want to go and live those lives, you know, like I want to do so many different things and experience and have those, I don't know, have those actual experiences rather than sit around dreaming about, oh, what if I could be this or be that? Does that make sense?
Well, what you're talking about, people used to call dropping out.
Yeah.
This was actually part of the playbook of the Beat Generation. And so in some ways, you're my hero because, you know, you're actually, while you still have some youth left, you know, I think you're availing yourself of the freedom that you have and recognizing it, where I think a lot of young people don't, and they're so eager to get to that point where they can become boring.
Right. And I think, you know, it's interesting. I will still be working. I'm still going to be, and the thing is, like, you know, I was just talking to my dad about this the other day. I could have sat there and worked a job that I was, you know, didn't like and was just doing to make some money and have done the whole regular life thing. I could, I mean, anyone can do that. I could do that. But I was saying to him, I don't understand why. Like, why would I do that if I can go explore something else? And a lot of people get even, interestingly, I mean, I guess it makes sense, but a lot of people do get angry when they hear about what I'm doing. They get really...
I'm sorry.
I mean, but I think it's because it points out their sort of, I don't know, and it's not intentional, but it really does go against what they're doing. And I'm not trying to be insulting, but I'm fine with however people want to live. I'm totally fine with that. Like, people who are okay with that, that's okay. That's fine. It's just for me, for my personal self, it did not feed me. And that's what I say on my website. It was not feeding me. That life was not feeding me at all. And I need that. I need to feel like I'm alive. And I didn't feel alive. I felt like I was a zombie in that machine. And it just did not work for me. And I've been working since I was a kid. My dad taught me personal responsibility since I was super young. And so I've been responsible for myself. And of course he did a great job, but it was like, I was responsible for my doing my own things as a child up through now. And I know there've been people who do that for their whole lives, and I'm still responsible for myself. It's just that I've done the work thing. I've had probably 25 different jobs in my lifetime. I have worked since I was young. It's just, I realize that I try and explore different avenues, I guess. A lot of people, I think, do that. Well, it is what it is. This is just how life goes. This is just what happens. I think that's bullshit. That's easy to say when you are afraid to make changes, I think. And I do understand that people are definitely in circumstances where it would be super challenging for them to make changes. However, a lot of times, if you want to do big things, you really do have to make sacrifices. And I have seen plenty. There are plenty of families who vagabond. There are plenty of old people, old couples, young couples. There are tons of people who do. And, you know, so I know, because you'd mentioned that I'm young. Yes, that's super beneficial to be young. But there are people who aren't young doing this. There are people who don't. I do not have money. That's the other thing. I'm not going out there with money. I'm not going out there with a safety net. I have very little money. And I'm just going to be, you know, very smart about how I'm doing this and really manage myself well and do these exchanges. See, I'm not like going and hoping everybody's just going to give me stuff. Like, okay, you know, give me a place to stay, money, do this. I'm going to be working. I'm going to be working in exchange for that food or exchange for that place to stay. Just like, you know, someone here is working for cash. I'm actually working for what I would say isn't money. I'm working for experiences. So I would much rather and the other cool thing is, you know, I'm not stuck to that. I don't have a contract. You know, I can go and go into Turkey, and I can work there at an exchange for, like, let's say 2, 3, 4 weeks somewhere in some city and get those experiences. And that's how I'm being paid in that culture. I'm being paid in this language, you know, these different things that I can see that I would never see. And, you know, one thing that's so interesting is how a lot of these people talk about valuing time. Time needs to be your currency, not money, because you really can't do it. I mean, you can do things with money, but you spend so much of that time trying to make that money. And then you have to spend more time to make more money or to maintain the money you already have. I just want the time. I don't even want the money. I really just want the time. And I don't have money. And so what I'm actually doing is so interesting. Is so many people say, well, if I had $200,000, then I would, you know, have the ability to have the time to do the things I want to do. Or if I work until I'm retired, then I'm going to have the time. Well, you're using between, you know, the time you were born up until you're, let's just say, 65, 70, 75, you're getting maybe 1 to 2 weeks of time off in that time. Your experience, the majority of your experience is sleeping, doing chores around the house and or running errands and working. That to me, and I'm not trying to be offensive, but for me, in my perspective, that isn't living. And I don't want that life for me. You know, want to go. So if I'm out there and I'm working, let's say 25 hours in, you know, at an organic farm, there's a lot of organic farms for this, and like Turkey or somewhere like that, I have then all that extra time in a place where I can be stimulated. I'm in a foreign place. I'm in a really exotic place to me. So even if I'm doing something that might seem tedious or mundane to someone else, it's a new activity for me. I mean, I have farmed before, but it's in a different place. They're going to have different styles in which they do things. I'm not going to know half of what's being said a lot of the time, if not, well, probably more like 90-some percent of what's being said. But it's just, it's a very different way to look at it is I want time and experiences to be my currency and not money. And that's, I'd never really heard about it in that way before, because you always, nobody would see it in this. I mean, the majority of people that live here, at least, do not ever think about things in that way. They always think about, well, when you retire, that's when you can do things. But a lot of people are just so burnt out by that time. You know, I mean, they're either burnt out or they're too sick, or they just, they're not able to function in that way.
And or like my father, you die before you get to enjoy that retirement.
Yeah, exactly. And that's, you know, I really, yeah, I mean, I just really can't. I personally just can't live my life in that way. I love meeting people. I love the stories that people have. I love just experiencing different cultures and just, you know, I love riding trains. I love walking and hiking around cities. And it's just kind of everything I want. It's everything I sort of love. And at the same time, I can still keep writing. And I'm going to get so much, and this has nothing to do with it, really, but and at least in our field, I'm going to have so much material all the time. I mean, I will have so much material, I won't even be able to write it all before I'm dead, I'm sure, you know? And that is also an amazing feeling if this is something we love so much to do, you know? So, and again, I didn't even consider the writing stuff when I made this decision at all. But later on, it came to me like, wow, I really can do the, you know, this will actually add to the thing I love. It will actually add to Palooka. It will add to my own writing life. And I think I can really hopefully touch other people, too, and let them know that you really can do these things, you know.
Well, and partly I'm such a, I don't know what, a business tool or something, but I would be thinking Palooka, the world tour, you know, and not what you're doing.
Right.
Which is way less cynical than what I would have imagined. Like, not that I wouldn't have seen a lot of what you're seeing in the opportunity, but, you know, my brain partly would be thinking, okay, how can I leverage this?
Huh. You know, I do have, I mean, I'm putting, for instance, I'm writing about, I'm actually seeing if I can get a visa. I don't know which country to yet, but I'm seeing if I can maybe get a visa to, as Palooka is sort of my business that I'm taking to sort of spread it around to people. And I'm definitely doing that too.
Ah.
I'm going to be giving out little cards to people that I meet with Palooka on it. So I'm going to be constantly talking about Palooka in the literary world and literary magazines and stuff with everybody too. So, I mean, it is a really nice way. And I'm putting my blog updates on the Palooka website too. So I really think it's just a win-win for people, for getting the idea of vagabonding out there again, I guess, because as you said, the Beats were doing that. I actually kind of hate the Beats, to be honest with you, which is kind of ironic, I think. But I know, right?
Why do you hate the Beats? Why do you hate the Beats?
I felt like a lot of it was interesting. Well, first of all, I really actually don't think Kerouac's a good writer at all.
I try to put it charitably and say that he's an uneven writer.
Okay, there we go. He's an uneven writer. You should be my PR person, because I'm not good at this stuff. But, you know, I think, well, he had a lot to fall back on. And I think that takes, I think it's interesting because they don't, I think a lot of times they didn't talk about the things they did have to fall back on and how they had safety nets everywhere, but yet that doesn't really appear in their books. And it doesn't falsify necessarily what they're doing, but it certainly changes the way in which you do things when you know you have money behind you. And for me, I have a really close friend. Her name is Shayna. I mentioned her in one of my blog posts. She certainly doesn't have money behind her. And actually, it's very difficult a lot of times. She's doing this solo. She's my age. She's out there right now. She's in Scotland working at a hospital. And it makes it a very different kind of challenge. And you have to make very different kinds of choices when you know, I really only have this amount of money. I can really only count on myself here. And I think that makes a really, it just makes it very different. That's all. I just find it more legitimate in this way. I've met so many people who, you know, I appreciate anyone who does this no matter what. I really appreciate people who are seeking out the culture in different communities and trying to really see what it's like in other places. I do have difficulty with people claiming to be something that I don't think they are.
Vagabonds with lots of safety nets are called tourists, if I'm not mistaken.
Correct. Yeah. Well, and then there's also, but see, I would never call them vagabonds ever, and I don't think they'd call themselves that either. But there were definitely lots of people who were doing this, who were claiming that they kind of act as if, you know, it's weird. They basically just, essentially they travel exactly like you say. They travel like tourists, essentially, with a few less accommodations, but they have lots of money behind them. And for instance, like, you know, my friend Shayna has been hitching all over because she doesn't have the means to get on planes and trains. Trains are actually super expensive. They're a lot more expensive than planes a lot of times over there. But there are other people who can take taxis everywhere. It's just a much, you know, it's a much more, it's just like, yeah, I mean, like you're saying, it's just like being a tourist. And that's not really the same thing, because it's not, in my opinion, that's less of it, because there's really no difference between that and the people who take, you know, I understand, you know, 3 weeks to go spend in Italy or something on vacation. That's like a vacation that's just extended, in my opinion. Again, I appreciate what they're doing and the way that they're actually trying to go, and I assume they're trying to learn about the cultures and they really want to experience these new things. But when it's just interesting when people try and portray themselves as people who are doing it in such a different, unique lifestyle way, when in reality, to me, it just seems like a very long-term vacation.
Well, I think it has a lot to do with our own cultural expectations of staying close to home and being boring for, and that's not really the most diplomatic way to put that, but, you know, what you're doing, I mean, it really, in a sense, goes back to Thoreau, you know, the dropping out thing, even if, you know, Thoreau had an even bigger safety net than the Beats did, but,
right. you're totally right. I completely agree. And that's the funny thing. A lot of people don't know about that either. But you're right. You're completely right. And I'm very much one of the, I mean, I got rid of my cell phone a couple of years ago. I'm very much a more, I don't know. I like things very simple. I really do. And I know it's interesting because what I'm doing is super complicated. But at the same time, my whole life is in a bag. That's it. I mean, my whole life is in a bag. And I have no idea if I'm coming back or when I'm coming back. It's just, I really am trying very hard to be in moments and to be elsewhere, I guess, than I'm familiar with in moments. Because I want to be the best version of myself I can possibly be and do the most I can possibly do with myself. And all I really want is for everybody to, at least at some point in their life, have that feeling and experience of, hey, I'm actually, you know how there's that cliche, almost like ironic, living the dream, you know, that whole thing. Yeah. I would love for to see people really doing that, and not saying that in an ironical way, but actually doing it at some point in their life, no matter what it is. If like somebody just wants to go and build like stick figures in the middle of Kentucky for like months on end, great. I wish there was a way in which they could figure out how to go and do that. You know, or people who want to go fishing somewhere off the coast, Cuba or something. I just think that, you know, we all have different kinds of dreams. I think it would be nice if we could get away from the dreams we're told to have and actually dig real deep down and figure out, well, is my real dream that I want these cars, these TVs, and this family, and this house, and this mortgage in this manner? Or do I have some sort of other dream that I actually should go after prior to maybe having this other dream? You know what I mean? Like, I just don't think we go after these really deep-seated dreams, because I think they're suppressed, just like how I think once you get out of grade school, they start suppressing that creativity and that sort of like that wow sort of factor of the world. It just becomes tedious grades, expectations. I'm not against expectation, but you know what I mean? We put on these parameters of this is how your life kind of needs to go now, and they don't like that.
We start quantifying work and accomplishment.
It's clear that I dislike, my father can definitely tell you this, but I've always disliked being told what to do. And even if it's in a very sly way that society can do these things, tell you what to buy and what to wear, and I don't like that. And it's never worked for me. I've always just been very simple. I've always just kind of wanted to really do the things I want to do, you know. And it's not like, and I'm very giving. As you probably know that, I'm a very giving person. I'm always about helping people and giving people and giving advice and trying to be there for people. That's really what I do. It's just, and it's interesting. I feel like I'm being, in a way, very selfish doing this for the first time, like really being, and I you know, but it's not hurting anyone in the self, you know, but I mean selfish and like I'm really doing something for me that I love and I've dreamed of doing, and but at the same time I'm going to be giving so much the whole time, and they're going to be giving to me, and I'm putting a lot of faith in people, so that's going to be challenging, you know, to put a lot of faith in people when you're, I'm a pretty isolated person in some ways, and so it's like, it's going to be interesting to do that, you know.
Well, I was really moved by your latest entry where you talk about going to a Royals game with your brother. And part of what impresses me is that you want to go vagabonding and you find America a worthwhile place to vagabond in. Not that you're limited to America, but that, you know, what we have around us you know, within driving distance, although for you, some of those distances are kind of long drives, but that you're just, all right, let's go here. Let's take a look. Let's go see what there is to do.
Yeah. And I wanted to say too, I have a lot of great support in terms of, like, I guess you moral support or whatever. Like, my brother has been fantastic. My really dear friend Jen has been fantastic. Shane is fantastic. My father is also really fantastic. And I've had a lot of friends and the people I worked with at Poudre Valley Hospital in Fort Collins, Colorado. They were super supportive. And I've had a lot of friends and people who are old writing friends and stuff. So there's a lot of people who are being super supportive, and I'm really happy about that. So it's not like, and it's really not, and in a way, you know, I'm glad to have those people that are encouraging. You know, it's really nice. You don't feel as alone. I'm going by myself. I've never done anything like this in my life. You know, I've traveled, but never left this where I have my life in a bag. I got rid of everything I own. I mean, this is it. This is all I have. And so this is really nice to at least have that, even though you're going to definitely feel very alone in a lot of these. And I actually had a friend of mine, his name is Kyle. He was super, he did this for, I think, about 2 years. And he actually had a really great kind of corporate job, and he just kind of realized the same things I guess I was realizing. He was making I was never making a lot of money, but he was making a good amount of money. And I think he realized the people above him were making shitloads of money, but nothing was good enough. They were never happy enough. It's like, I need another boat. I need another house. You know, that kind of thing. And I think sometimes that dream we shoot for when it comes to money, I just think that really falls short. Because you see so many people constantly unhappy doing those lives, you know, constantly trying to fill it with all these objects, and they don't know how to fill themselves inside. And I think that's really what this is about too. So around us here, and that's the other thing, is I was really lucky. My father, ever since we were young, he really instilled in us that experiences are so valuable. So we had no money. I mean, we never had money. You know, we lived in a crappy duplex my whole life. But he, instead of, you know, doing that thing where you buy a nice car, you buy a house or whatever, he spent the only money we had taking us places because he wanted us to see the country. And then eventually, like I said, I was 8 years old when he took us to Europe. It's so funny where you're essentially broke and yet he's taking the only money you have to give you experiences. So when I kind of told him I was doing this, because he took it. So I guess my point was, yes, I'd been to California and Texas and Florida and the East Coast and the West Coast and the North and the Canada. And so I'd been all over the country here. And so that's the thing I love about the United States is there are so many amazing landscapes, even just driving through Iowa, which I grew up in Iowa. Even just driving through Iowa, which most people think is super boring, it was gorgeous. I really did. It was just so beautiful, the way the hills rolled with the green and the yellow. And it was just like, it just really reminded me of when I'd been in Germany. And it was just like, wow, I don't know. I had this other feeling as I was coming home this time. But yeah, there is a ton of beauty around here. And it's not that I'm saying there isn't. I just want to get out of this the English-speaking, comfortable zone that I have here. Because anywhere I kind of go in this country, I feel pretty comfortable considering, you know. Kind of want to really challenge myself to get out there, to go somewhere where I've got to see, well, what are other cultures like? How will they react to me? How will I react to them? You know, and then go. I plan on also going to Southeast Asia for a while, Australia, New Zealand, North Africa, hopefully South Africa. I mean, I really want to go to a lot of places. And, of course, Antarctica at some point. I'd like to hit all the continents at some point.
Well, should you find yourself in Florida, I have a couch all ready for you. And
nice.
So my listeners can check you out at rockonvagabond.com. And if you haven't checked out Palooka, you should absolutely check out that magazine because it's something special. Jonathan, thank you so much for being on the show, and I wish you safe travel, sir.
Great, and thank you so much for your submission to the magazine and your contribution and for having me on your wonderful podcast.
Excellent. Thank you so much, sir, and keep up the good work.
Thank you.
And now, a book discussion, a book that changed my life.
A Modern Odyssey of Vocation by Rusty Kjarvik. I was 18 years old, returning to my mother's South Shore home in Massachusetts after my first few months away at university. It began one evening, at the end of a series of meditations where, motionless, I reconceived the magic psalms of Ginsberg's Elemental Void, the enlightened palms of Snyder's versified mudra, and the delicate alms of Kerouac's prosaic spontaneity. In the pitch darkness, I wrote Tat Vam Asi on the wall with my trusty writing pencil. "You are it," translated Alan Watts, whose English clarity rung through my mind with echoing resonance, reverberating interminably to the next day when I had read every word on my bookshelf and sought more. I set out to the library of my Greek-Jewish Romaniote grandfather, whose literary meditations on the healing properties of the written word had sent him unscathed from World War II to the centenarian desk. There he sat, with a penknife shakily opening letters, as his Polack Jewish wife screamed from the downstairs banister, "Take whatever you want!" He spoke over the long-winded cacophony of domestic affairs. In the name Katsantzakis, I saw another Greek, an ancestral voice unperturbed by the walled house. In a moment of intuition, scanning through the compendium of classics, I chose The Odyssey, a modern sequel. Crouched inside my off-white walls, completely bare if not for the Sanskrit scribble, and a prized first draft poem hanging deliriously like a whitewashed door of perception, I began reading everything, the copyright date, the ISBN code, and every insignificant character in between. Smashed skulls, bespattered bowels, and upended spines weaned my consciousness from a walled indoor adolescence. My mind voyaged onward into the travails of a maturing intellect. Spawned with a Greek flair for disinhibiting fleshly experience, I read with a burning momentum. I needed to feel each word pulsate its rhythms of modern wisdom into every minutia of my being. I began reciting with a quickening taste of the classical orator, moved by the enigmatic grandeur of such literary quality. Soon it was dusk, and the tired footsteps of my stepfather climbed the stairs to rest his weary skull on a pillow of televised static. Reading, reciting, orating, on and on, and into my pores sunk the blood of the fallen men and raped women, and from my nostrils leaked the icy salt of the Mediterranean seas. I wept with unspoken clarity for the emotional barbarism of modern spiritual greed. At a break in the violent awe, I spoke sweet lines of sexual camaraderie. Women's voices formed on my dry tongue as the fecund prosperity of mortal despair. In those tempestuous rhythms, my drunken brothers stumbled longingly upstairs to lust in the barfly haven of suburban coitus. Undeceived, unwilling to desist, I read on, with soft muttering in the depths of red twilight as Morpheus, the Greek god of sleep, laid the house to rest. In my empty hollow, I swam to the subterranean netherworlds of the creative subconscious. Emerging, still as ever, with the light of morning, my mother's knock could not startle my ever-strengthening concentration. I savored each of the 33,333 17-syllable verses as a ripe, freshly picked Kalamata olive, cleansing my palate as with my cognitive sensibility. The unique versification of Katsantzakis' voice led me onward into the depths of creative literacy as I relished on his startlingly characteristic use of nouns, at once subjectively descriptive, while aesthetically presented with a definitive tone of proverbial lists. His Cretan glance remains unmatched in modern literature, evoking the spirit of the Mediterranean as an invocation to the deified ancestral hearth of earthly humanity, the book. On reading the final character, I threw the book into the air and sprang from my narrowing walls before the book crashed onto an unlit lamp. Visiting relatives, weakly frightened, noticed my sorry state, and their misguided sympathies amplified under the crushing noise of broken glass. After being handed a Greek salad to end my bookish fast, I greeted my grandfather, whose smile shone with mutual respect and ancestral fraternity, as two men of pure literacy. Outside, a childhood friend stood to greet me. We had not seen each other since prepubescence. Her eyes, crooked, observed my own downward slant into the abnormal body of creative tradition. I was not mad, I was not sane, and yet, from that moment, her eyes told me what she could not. I was rapt, eternally in the powerful vocation of the word of silence and thought. A Modern Odyssey of Vocation by Rusty Pjarvik. Read by Nathan Hollick.
And now, the Drunken Odyssey mailbag.
This week, again in the mailbag, I heard from Ryan Rivas. He wrote, Hemingway got in a fistfight with Wallace Stevens in Key West. This happened in 1936. If a hole in the space-time continuum were to open up at the southernmost point during the time when Hunter Thompson was there, and if the good doctor got sucked back in time to the moment of the 36th fistfight, how would he react? Who would he side with? Describe the scene as you imagine it. Okay, Ryan. What I object to in this question is the speculative tone you've adopted, as if this event could have happened when physicists who subscribe to quantum mechanics believe that what you are describing is a certainty. Of course, my favorite scenario involves Hunter S. Thompson trying to stop the melee with Catherine Ann Porter swinging a bottle of gin at Wallace Stevens' head after Hemingway knocked him down. Meanwhile, Christopher Smart was back at the compound worshipping Hemingway's cats. But what lurks in the guts of this question are two real concerns. One, what was Hunter S. Thompson's character? And two, as one celebrated icon of masculinity, what did Hunter think of Hemingway? Even if we could wormhole Hunter S. Thompson into the year of our Lord 1936, getting him voluntarily into the party where this fistfight occurred is difficult to imagine. Hemingway himself wasn't attending this party and only crashed the scene when he heard Wallace Stevens, that hater, was dissing him. Yo, so check this out. Sorry. Hunter probably wouldn't have attended a Wallace Stevens party. What's that I hear? Who is Wallace Stevens? Wallace Stevens was a modern American poet, famous for a relatively opaque yet evocative style. Among the difficult poets, T.S. Eliot, Ezra Pound, William Carlos Williams, and so forth, Stevens happens to be my favorite. I feel like the challenges of his work and the often prosaic concreteness of it make me feel especially rewarded. Plus, his book of essays, The Noble Writer and the Sound of Words, is amazing. One of the oddities, perhaps, of Stevens' life is that he had a squarely middle-class day job in the insurance business. So, Hemingway showed up at this party after he heard that Wallace Stevens was dissing him, and the fight lasted one punch long. So, between his day job and his exalted status among the intelligentsia, Wallace Stevens would likely only attend parties that Hunter S. Thompson would consider poisonous. But also, Hunter S. Thompson was, his chaotic and psychedelic antics notwithstanding, both a shy person and a southern gentleman. From what I can gather, Hunter's idea of a good time was to drink wild turkey while watching pro football, or going out to a range to shoot, preferably the range on his ranch. I can't imagine him loitering with society people. If you want to know what a gonzo time is like in the Keys, read his story about being on Sugarloaf Key called Tales of the Swine Family. I think that's in the Gonzo Papers, Volume 3. Hunter enjoyed living life as something of an outlier, an outsider, so that he would be less contaminated by the cant of the mainstream. If I have to conjure up the good doctor and place him at that party, I see him at a bar stool by the bar, drinking and smoking, and watching this lopsided fistfight with sardonic bemusement at what human beings can be reduced to over the silliness of literary reputations, or maybe just at the very incongruity of the spectacle itself. But in terms of action, I think he'd mind his own business, at least in this event. As for what Hunter thought of Hemingway, Hunter saw in Hemingway a flawed model for how to be a writer. Keep in mind that Hemingway was a modernist and Hunter was, in his vision of reality at least, a postmodernist. 3 years after Hemingway's suicide, Hunter, as a young, still relatively mainstream journalist, wrote a story called What Lured Hemingway to Ketchum that appeared in The Gonzo Papers, Volume 1, The Great Shark Hunt. In this profile, Thompson visited the last city where Hemingway lived. It's a really good piece of journalism, if not of literary history. And in it, Thompson meditates on Hemingway's career. He links Hemingway's decline to that of many other modernists whose confidence in writing about the world faltered after World War II. Thompson wrote, "Today we have Mailer, Jones, and Styron, three potentially great writers bogged down in what seems to be a crisis of convictions brought on, like Hemingway's, by the mean nature of a world that will not stand still long enough for them to see it clear as a whole. In many ways, this is the unspoken reason for the greatness of Hunter S. Thompson. He did not have any traditional heroes. He was always more interested in the truth. His real hero, early on, was Jack Kerouac, not Hemingway. And so the good news, in a way, is that Hemingway could not disillusion Thompson the way that Kerouac, as a closer contemporary, clearly did. And I mean hard. If Kerouac ultimately could not fulfill a bohemian life, then existentially, anyone who might revere Kerouac must start from scratch and create a personality that could cope with the madness of this world. That was Hunter's greatest accomplishment, and it was maddening that the world he faced, like Gary Trudeau, turned him into a comic strip character, a product for the world to consume, or perhaps this is worse, a model for how to live one's life. The point is to find out for oneself. So ultimately, Ryan, I don't know what Hunter Thompson would have done. It's actually too difficult a question to answer even what I would have done. So ultimately, Ryan, I don't know what Hunter Thompson would have done. It's actually too difficult a question to answer even what I would have done, even though, in my own peculiar way, I regard Hemingway and Stevens as closer contemporaries as Hunter Thompson did. To answer that is to say precisely who I am, and that is a question whose answer changes from moment to moment as all the little moments of my life get strung together. What's that, Lauren?
Dear listeners, writers, and fellow Odysseans, send your questions, observations, complaints, manifestos, transcriptions of Turkish opera, and whatever else you got to thedrunkenodyssey@gmail.com.
Well, that's all the show I have for this week. Thanks again to Jonathan Starkey, Safe Travels Out There, Sir. And thanks to Rusty Kjarvik. And thank you, dear listeners, for once again downloading me into your brain. Keep your ass in the chair, keep attacking those keys, and don't swallow the worm.